Hey, Proof listeners. Plougra's premium European-style butter is a favorite of bakers. Why? Cook's Illustrated recipe developer, Erica Turner, sums it up.
Hey, Kevin. Did you know that the kind of butter you use when you're baking can actually make a difference in how your dish turns out?
I did not.
Butters that are slow-churned, like Plougra, are easier to work with because they make doughs more pliable. The amount of fat in the butter also makes a difference.
Tell me more.
Okay, so most American butters contain around 80% butterfat, but European-style butters, like Plougra, have a higher fat content. In fact, Plougra Premium European-style butter always contains 82% butterfat.
And you're saying 2% is enough to make a noticeable difference?
Oh, yeah, definitely. With Plougra Slow Churn Butter and its 82% butterfat content, you'll notice richer, flakier pastries, cakes that rise higher, and cookies that crisp more easily.
Embrace your inner butter lover, from professional kitchens to your home. Visit Plougra.com for more information. I'm staring outside the window of America's Test Kitchen's Boston studios, and winter just can't seem to unclench her frigid grasp. Not only is it cold, but it is gusty outside, which makes it feel even colder. And so, your mind wanders to someplace warmer, where gusts of frigid wind are replaced by a gentle sea breeze. The water is a cerulean blue. You know, this very moment, it sure would be nice to visit a place like Greece. And that is where we're going to take you to right now, where the reporter of today's episode, Avery Thompson, is based.
For the past few years now, I've been splitting my time between the U.S. and Greece. I'm a radio producer, and during the summers, I run an artist residency program at a beachside resort in Halkidiki. It's in the northeastern part of the country, and is on the Aegean Sea. I'll admit that it's a nice mix, being able to bounce back and forth between the two countries. For half the year, I'm taking a slow approach to life, or siga-siga, as the Greeks call it. And then the other half of the year, I'm back in the hustle and bustle of the States. And of course, I eat well throughout the year, benefiting from two wildly different, but equally delicious, food worlds. So in summer, it's souvlaki and moussaka and grilled octopus. Then it's back to burgers and barbecue, and yes, even the occasional apple pie. Inevitably, though, wherever I am, after a few months, I start to miss the foods I left behind. I'll be in the U.S. and suddenly get a hankering for baklava, or I'll be in Greece and find myself craving a Reuben. But there's one dish that I never seem to miss, the Greek salad. Because no matter where I'm hanging my hat, a Greek salad is always close at hand. Though, what is often called a Greek salad in the States bears little resemblance to the one you'd find in Greece.
Today on Proof from America's Test Kitchen, how did the Greek salad become so ubiquitous on both sides of the Atlantic? And why can two salads with the same name look so different? I'm Kevin Pang. Stick around. Reporter Avery Thompson brings us today's story.
On a sunny day in August, with the sounds of cicadas overhead, I meandered through the narrow streets of Athens' oldest neighborhood, Plaka. Zigging and zagging between the throngs of tourists, I passed quaint little houses covered in blooming bougainvillea. I made my way to a traditional old Greek taverna called Platanos. I was meeting up with local chef, cookbook author, and culinary producer of the USA TV series My Greek Table.
I'm Carolina Doriti. My voice is too heavy again,
That's
eh?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah?
It's like, hi.
Having lived and worked abroad for many years, Carolina Doriti has a worldly perspective that's only increased her love for her country's cuisine. Also, she showed up to Platanos Taverna wearing a super cool bucket hat.
I am a cookbook author, and I recently released my cookbook, Salt of the Earth, Secrets and Stories from a Greek Kitchen, which is a book that really talks about the history of Greek cuisine and the main ingredients that have been used historically throughout the years.
Now, throughout this episode, you'll hear us interchanging the words Greek salad and horiadiki, as it's known in Greece. And for the most part, these two terms are interchangeable, especially as more and more menus in Greece translate horiadiki as Greek salad. But technically,
horio means village. So horiadiki is from a village. Although now it's popular, of course, all over Greece. They prepare it everywhere. We make it at home. And there are many, many different variations of the recipe.
So when Greeks say horiadiki, the idea is that they're eating like a villager. A nod to the simple meals enjoyed by shepherds and farmers out in the rustic hinterlands. Though, truth be told, this is a little disingenuous. More of a cute idea, or clever branding. Because the horiadiki was an urban invention, founded right here in Plaka, and way more recently than you might imagine. But before any Greeks get up in arms, I will acknowledge right off the bat that there are some major differences between a horiadiki in Greece and the Greek salad that you might find in the USA or elsewhere outside of Greece.
So you never see lettuce in a Greek salad in Greece. I think they did this for volume and because of the fact that the tomatoes are not always great.
But we'll get to why the American version of Greek salad looks so different in the second half of the episode. For now, we'll stick with the Greek version, horiadiki, which consists of the following ingredients.
Tomatoes.
Cucumber.
And peppers. Red onion.
It needs a black olive.
A wedge of feta.
Oregano. And definitely some Greek olive oil.
There are obviously different variations of it, but at the core, this combination of ingredients are what make a horiadiki. Greeks have been eating salads of some kind since the ancient times. It was the famous physician Hippocrates, whose oath doctors still take to this day, that recommended eating raw vegetables at the start of a meal to better absorb their nutrients and aid in digestion. But don't go thinking that those ancient Greeks were lounging around the Acropolis chowing down on a tasty Greek salad. Because as Carolina explained, for the better part of Greece's long history, an essential component of the Greek salad was missing. Tomatoes.
Even though people associate tomatoes with Greece a lot, and even Greek people and myself included, it's funny to think that tomatoes did not originate from the Mediterranean. So they came from Peru and Mexico.
So it wasn't until Christopher Columbus started sailing the ocean blue in 1492 that Europeans even knew what a tomato was. And even after tomatoes made their way over to Europe, it took many more years for them to reach Greece.
Because of the fact that when tomatoes started coming into Europe, Greece was Ottoman-occupied, tomatoes reached Greece even later.
It was Capuchin monks who were often credited with bringing the tomato seeds into Greece, first to the island of Syros, and then on to Plaka. And interestingly, those first Greek tomatoes were not even grown with the intention to be eaten.
Yeah, they were planted in 1818 for aesthetic reasons. Also, Athenians started planting them for aesthetic reasons in the beginning in their, like, gardens and balconies. And then gradually they started including it into their cuisine towards the late half of the 1800s.
So if it weren't for some monks trying to gussy up their monasteries, who knows if or when the Greek salad would have ever come to be? All right, I'm stretching there, but we can at least give those old monks some credit for moving things along. And of course, despite the tomato's late arrival to this part of the world, they caught on like wildfire, becoming an essential component of the Mediterranean diet. And in Greece, one of the main ways that tomatoes were eaten was as part of a summer salad with cucumbers and other vegetables. All right, so we got our Greek salad here. We have red onions, tomato.
Red onions are very important. because they're very sweet in Greece during the summer. This is a summer salad. Everything is at its best during summer. The onions are sweet and crispy. The tomatoes are very juicy and very sweet. And the cucumbers are very firm and crispy and without seeds, really. People may put green peppers in a Greek salad, necessarily olives. Some people put capers. Oregano is a must. But the most important element is a tomato because of the juices and because of the fact that it mixes with the olive oil.
But of course, we still haven't mentioned the star of the Greek salad, feta.
So feta is a cheese that for Greek people is extremely important. You know, Greek people are the biggest cheese eaters in the whole of Europe. Everybody thinks it's the French.
This claim is a much argued fact. And depending on what source, some say it's Greece, others France. But my biased opinion is that I find it hard to imagine the French eating as much cheese as the Greeks. From the moment you wake up here to the moment you go to bed, feta just seems to be everywhere. And for all I know, the Greeks dream about it too.
It's not on a cheese platter, it's on their everyday table. Breakfast, pies, lunch, dinner, with watermelon as a snack, with like anything.
Why?
Because it's great. And you know, feta for Greek people is what champagne is for the French. It's super important. And the European law protects it the same way it protects champagne. Because, you know, there is a specific recipe for feta.
That recipe, according to the European Union's PDO label, or Protected Designation of Origin, demands that to be labeled Greek feta, the cheese must be made using the milk from native breeds of sheep and goats. It also has to have a fat content of at least 6% and come from specific regions in Greece.
Not everybody in Greece can make feta. That's why if you go to islands like Santorini or like Crete, islands that are famous for their cuisine, they will not, I mean, they do have feta because it's Greek, but they do not legally produce a cheese that is called feta.
So knowing how much Greeks love feta and the front and center stage it takes in Greek salad, you might be surprised to learn that feta was the last piece of the Greek salad puzzle. Prior to the creation of the Horiadiki, Greeks were eating salads and they were eating feta, but not necessarily on the same plate. For that union to occur, another historic event needed to happen in Greece. Something that would not only impact its cuisine, but completely transform the country. Tourism.
With true claim to the very meaning of the finest aspiration of the human heart and mind, we stand with respect before Greece, the very foundation of Western civilization.
In the 1960s, with Greece no longer plagued by wars, the country became an international hotspot for the growing leisure classes of the world, who were drawn to its natural beauty, ancient history, and of course, its tasty food. And those tourists, just like all the locals, were absolutely loving this tasty tomato and cucumber salad. And it was so cheap, too. Cheap for a very specific reason.
In the 1960s and 70s, the government controlled certain prices, you know, in order to control the market. Among these products that they were trying to control were tomatoes and cucumbers.
With much of its population impoverished, the Greek government set price caps on items to keep them affordable for its citizens, even if the tourists were willing to pay much more. The Greek government still does this to a degree today. For example, you can't charge more than 50 cents for a simple water bottle. So back in the 1960s...
there was a lot of tourism at the time, and people in Plaka, they wanted to take advantage of that, so they tried to elaborate a little bit more on it.
Meaning, taverna owners wanted to be able to charge those hungry tourists more for that very popular tomato and cucumber salad.
So they added the olive oil and a big chunk of feta, basically. Which helped them cheat the law.
And they called this new salad, with a big hunk of feta on it, horiadaki.
And actually, you know, they could charge the salad as much as they wanted to because of the cheese addition. And that's how the salad was born.
Soon, every taverna in the area followed suit, throwing on feta, maybe some capers, whatever else they wanted into their salad, and saying to the government officials, look, this isn't the simple tomato, cucumber, and onion salad anymore. It's a new thing called horiadaki, so we can charge whatever the heck we want. So the creation of the Greek salad as we know it is actually the result of some rascally Greek business owners in Plaka circumventing government regulation. But if you've ever spent any time in Greece, maybe this reluctance of Greek people to let the government meddle in their financial affairs won't come as a surprise. Because Greeks are notorious for the efforts they'll take to game their own system. And they'd be the first to admit it.
Well, everybody's so closely checked with everything that they really try to hide, even if they're not doing anything wrong.
Just recently, the governor of the Bank of Greece told media outlets that recent tax evasion in the country exceeds 60 billion euros annually, which, to put it into perspective, is more than the entire GDP of about a dozen European countries. Then he went on to call the Greek people the, quote, champion tax evaders of Europe. And don't even get me started on the income taxes here, where if it's an election year, oftentimes the ruling party won't even send out the local tax collectors because they want to stay in the good graces of the voters. To help understand Greek people's reluctance to hand their money over to the government, I turned to Dr. Alexander Kitriff. He's an Athenian-born historian and professor emeritus at Haverford College in the USA. He says that Greek tax avoidance is not a recent phenomenon.
The Greeks are reluctant to pay their taxes because they've got a very antagonistic relationship to the Greek state, which really goes back to pre-independence time, when Greece was part of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was known for locally arbitrary rules, so you had to strike deals with a particular ruler.
Under Ottoman occupation, the Greek populace saw tax avoidance as a form of civil protest. But even after Greece gained independence, things didn't get all that much better. Because according to Dr. Kitriff, there wasn't a large entrepreneurial Greek middle class. And the government grew very big, requiring lots of civil servants to keep the country functioning.
And if you have a lot of civil servants, you need to pay them. And the only way you can pay them is by taxing the rest of the population. So taxation, historically, was very heavy from the 19th century onwards. And we should also add the civil service is known for being notoriously slow, inefficient. There's a lot of red tape. So why should I pay my taxes for this guy who's sitting there at the table drinking his coffee and reading the sports newspaper before looking at all the files they're supposed to do? If the Greek can get away from paying taxes, they will do so because there's a suspicion that the state doesn't work.
Carolina Duriti puts it a little more succinctly.
It could be a soap opera. The taxes and the government in Greece.
And that soap opera between the Greek government and its taxpayers is still airing to this day. And the evidence of it was littered all over Carolina and I's table.
We have a receipt here with a QR code on it. This is pretty standard everywhere you go in Athens now. Receipts all over the table every time you order.
Yes, don't get offended. Every time you make the slightest order, even a bottle of water, they need, by law, to bring a receipt on your table and kind of put it somewhere on the table in case they check them. Because if they do check them and they do not have a receipt for the one bottle of water on your table, they will have to pay a huge fine.
The QR code receipts is one way in which the government is trying to crack down on what it sees as rampant tax evasion by local businesses. So if you go out to eat with a bunch of people in Athens, pretty soon your dining table will start looking like an accountant's desk in April. Things have gotten so heated between the government and businesses in Greece that in recent years the Greek tax authority rolled out a campaign called apodixy, please, meaning receipt, please, which encourages tourists to ask for their receipt for every purchase. And if the establishment doesn't provide the requested receipt, then, under the authority of this government program, the customer doesn't have to pay for whatever it was they bought. So keep that in mind the next time you pop over here for a holiday. You'll see TV commercials with cheesy music like this, and billboards at the airport reminding you about it. Oh, and what did the apodixy please advertisements use in their ads as the emblematic Greek purchase? Yep, you guessed it. A delicious-looking horiadiki.
Go for it.
Yeah?
We gotta enjoy it.
Thank you.
I also want to add, this is a very authentic Greek experience. We have a cat sitting next to us at the table.
Black cat.
Well-behaved.
Horiadiki is not just something that you'll find in tavernas and restaurants in Greece. You'll also see it in Greek homes. And to get a better understanding of Greek people's relationship with homemade horiadiki, I traveled to Greece's second largest city, Thessaloniki, to speak with Phyllis Kazakos. He's a local tour guide and fourth generation olive vendor.
We're in the open market in downtown Thessaloniki. It's very old, you know. It's from the 16th century, so you can imagine how old it is. Here you can find anything you want, from vegetables, from fruits, from fish, meat.
Restaurants as well. I see some tavernas.
Yes, there are many traditional tavernas and restaurants, let's say. Everything is on the grill, so what you order, they make it now with fresh meat. Actually, from here. They buy it from here.
For many Greeks, making their first horiadiki is a ritual passed down through generations. And Phyllis was no exception.
I was young, but enough young so I can walk in the market. And my mother said, you will go to this guy to take tomatoes, you will go to the other guy to take cucumbers, and you will go to the next guy to take feta. I said, okay, mother. I took some money and I went. Yeah, it's like a tradition. Everyone's time will come to create the Greek salad. Everyone has to be inside the Greek salad so that they know it's something of ours, you know? 100% Greek.
For others, including Dr. Kitrov, who we heard from earlier, the task falls on the grandparents, particularly the grandmas, or the yayas.
That's right. It's the grandmothers who teach us. And the first step is the Greek salad. Before you can learn anything else, you yourself will want to learn that. And that's the first recipe that grandmother's going to teach a young Greek kid, and then the rest will follow.
As Phyllis took me around the market, he also suggested that the horiadiki represents the Greek people and their struggles.
Here in Greece, we have a long history of financial hardship. And because of that, money is not our best friend. Many Greeks made under 1,000 euros per month. And also we have the taxes.
See? There we go again with the taxes.
So when you go to a Greek diner table, you can see our economy. Because everything was made in Greece. We cannot afford fancy ingredients or import many things from abroad. Everything about the food is made in Greece, and that's what we can afford. But we like it. And because it's 100% Greek, we are proud of it.
What Phyllis is talking about is something that I've come to understand about Greece over the years of living here. Yes, there's Mykonos and Santorini and all sorts of fancy places to party or take that dream honeymoon. But the reality is that most Greeks live very modestly. Their salaries are some of the lowest in Europe, and their taxes quite high. Also, many Greeks in the tourism industry will work the entirety of an extended summer season with little or no days off. And when the tourists leave, they go back to their city or village and live frugally on whatever they manage to save up until the next tourist season. So it makes sense that they would want to keep every hard-earned euro they make and not give it away to the government, which has, in their eyes, historically mismanaged their money.
You know, it's tradition to, in Greece, when you go to a house, to ask you if you want something to eat. You will not find international things, international products. You will find 100% Greek products. And this is what makes us happy, because we know that it's local from our country.
And the Horiadiki is a perfect example of this Greek reliance on simple, locally produced ingredients.
From the tomato, to the oregano, in the end, to the feta cheese, to the virgin olive oil. You know, because everything is pure, everything is from here, everything is local. So,
in a way, it's a celebration of the country, of the land.
Exactly, yes. It's a celebration of the country.
Are Greeks proud of their food?
Of course they are. They are proud for everything, okay, but about food?
People can't see you rolling your eyes there.
When we talk about food, Greeks are like generals. Whatever they say, it's correct. You don't have to ask why, because it is, and that's it. It's like a law.
So while the Horiadiki, as it's served today, is a fairly recent invention, in those six or so decades since, the salad has become a ubiquitous dish throughout the country, rising to something like a national institution in Greece, and a source of great pride for its people.
Greeks are very much aware of the popularity of that salad, and that's why I think we are seeing it being described more as Greek salad rather than Horiadiki, because it's becoming an international symbol of Greece. And Greeks being very proud and wishing to transmit their culture worldwide, I think they're seizing on this and looking at the salad, the Greek salad, as something emblematic of the Greek cuisine.
After the break, we'll cross the Atlantic to learn how this national dish of Greece became such a hit on American soil and why it looks so wildly different. And now, back to our story.
They like invented math, science, modern architecture, drama, comedy, plumbing, the Olympics. And in 300 BC, they hung up their tool belt and said, "Yeah, we're good. We're gonna, for the next 2,000 years, let's take all our energy, all our focus, all our genius, let's work on salad." And they knocked it out of the park.
That's American comedian Gary Goldman singing the praises of the Greek salad. And Gary isn't the only American who loves a Greek salad. While back in New York for the holidays, I went to my local diner on Long Island. This is the place my family used to come after formal events like graduations or funerals. And truth be told, it's also the place my friends and I would go first thing in the morning to order something greasy when we drank too much the night before. And it turns out that American diners, like this one, were instrumental in turning the humble Horiadiki of Greece into the international superstar that Greek salad has become. And right here on the first page of the menu, boom, Greek salad. Albeit at a whopping $15.50, which is a pretty steep jump from the 7 euro salad Carolina and I shared. But that's just one of the many ways that this American diner version of the Greek salad differs from the one we ate in Athens. Greeks have been coming to the Americas since as early as the 1500s. But it was in the 20th century that the Greek diaspora reached its height, according to Dr. Kitroff.
The earlier wave disperses throughout the United States. East Coast, obviously, Chicago, they go up to New England to work in textile mills, down to Pennsylvania and Virginia mines, and then they go out west with the railroads and the mines. But the Greeks who arrive after World War II quite clearly stay on the East Coast.
It's important to note that the Greeks that emigrated didn't arrive with boatloads of money, and most spoke little to no English. And with other industries already crowded by preceding groups of immigrants, the Greeks took work wherever they could get it. And by and large, that work was in kitchens.
It is really after World War II when we notice increasing numbers of Greeks going into the diner business, either because Jewish and Irish American owners are selling or are moving out for some reason. But that's when you notice that the Greeks get identified with the diners.
Which is interesting, because they don't have diners in Greece. It's an American institution.
I think the Greeks bring their own background to the diner, their background from Greece. They haven't done any MBAs. They haven't gone to any culinary schools. But they've seen the village taverna. They've seen the village coffee shop. And they are by nature social. And I think they interact with the customers in a way that makes their diner very popular. A diner is a place where someone is looking for some kind of company and social interaction anyway. And I think the Greek is tailor-made to offer that.
Dr. Kitroff says that despite this second wave of immigrants not having experience with diners in Greece, they did have some inherent qualities that suited them for the work.
Food plays a very important in Greek culture. The family gets together around the table, not unlike other ethnic groups, but nonetheless very, very pronounced for the Greeks. So it makes total sense for them to go into the restaurant business. It's something that they feel at home at, especially when they get to do the cooking and the serving. That's something that's very close to their own experiences back home.
And as Greeks started to purchase diners of their own, they packed the staff with more Greeks.
Another reason why the Greeks went into the diner business and were successful into the diner business, because it's a business tailor-made for the family. Walk into any diner and the owner's going to be in the back at the grill. His wife's going to be at the till, and the kids are going to be the servers. So that's the family nature of working in a diner and the strong family bonds that the Greeks bring over from Greece when they're in America kind of gel together.
Before long, Greeks had a stronghold on the diner scene in the Northeast. From the 1950s through the 1970s, Greek immigrants founded more than 600 diners in the New York and New Jersey metro area. And with all these Greeks owning diners, inevitably, they started putting some Greek items like gyros and moussaka on their menus. And yes, of course, horiadaki.
Well, for sure, those diner owners introduced the Greek salad to American people. So to the extent that the flavors were brought, then yeah, absolutely.
That's Dino Kalitzis, a first-generation Greek-American whose father was one of those Greek immigrants who found their footing in American diners.
My dad started as a dishwasher when he came from Greece in 1955. And he worked as a dishwasher for about 2 or 3 months before a chef in New York City said to him, you know, you're a smart guy, let me teach you a few things.
Dino has since followed in his dad's footsteps, opening a restaurant of his own, albeit one that looks a lot different from the one his father was slinging food out of. It's called Greca Mediterranean Kitchen and Bar, and it's in Connecticut. Growing up as the child of a Greek chef here in the USA, Dino saw firsthand how the horiadaki he ate at home, or on family trips to Greece, differed from the Greek salad on the menus of restaurants in the States.
Well, you know, Greek food was introduced to the Americans by the diner owners, pizzeria owners, and later in the Greek festivals that started popping up all over the place. Their reality was that they had to produce food at a low cost. They had menus, especially in those diners, that were just gigantic. So spinach pie, spanakopita, moussaka, pasticho, all these things, they're made and they're frozen. And they were taken out little by little and served. Just because how much moussaka are you going to sell on a menu that's got, you know, 300 items? They introduced it, and I'm grateful to them. My father was one of those chefs. You know, when he left the restaurants, he went to the diners because it was a better life for a chef with a young family. But I think that the Greek salad that we serve here in the United States, it's like eating Chinese food here and eating Chinese food in China or Taiwan. There's no comparison. The same thing here with the Greek salad. It's an American adaptation of a Greek salad.
As for that adaptation, Dino suggests that the introduction of lettuce was, yes, partly a way for Greek diner owners to add cheap bulk and mask inferior ingredients.
Well, the Greek salad here in the USA is just, you know, lettuce where there's no lettuce in a real Horiatiki salad, in a real Greek salad. And then they toss in, you know, crumbled feta, and usually it's not a very good feta. It's, you know, the least expensive on the market because they don't know what good feta is anyway. That type of attitude.
And oftentimes, that feta, or what I hesitate to even call feta, is a dry, American-made version, abiding by totally different standards of production, which even permits it to be made with cow's milk, which would probably get a cheesemaker in Greece cast out of society if they tried such a thing. And the American tomatoes weren't much better.
The same tomatoes that they used to put us on a hamburger are the same tomatoes that are going to be used typically in a Greek salad.
But adding lettuce to the Horiatiki was also a savvy response by Greek diner owners to make their traditional food more palatable to an American audience. An audience who, by and large, equated salad with lettuce. Dr. Kitroff recalls a time he visited a Greek restaurant outside Philadelphia that had just been opened by a recent Greek immigrant.
The guy came up and said, you know, a customer came and told me that the Greek salad has to have lettuce in it. And I don't put lettuce. And my friend who had been in the States for years, he said, look, you're in America. The customer is always right. They think the salad's got to have lettuce. You've got to put lettuce in it. And I think lettuce originally was a way in which you would introduce the other ingredients to Americans.
And in keeping with the American maxim of more is better, these diner owners didn't stop at lettuce. In a move that harkens back to those Plaka Taverna owners in the first half of the episode, the Greek diner owners in the USA saw an opportunity to increase their profit margins by adding to the Greek salad and turning what was once a simple summer salad into a full-fledged entree available year-round. Dr. Kitroff remembers first coming to the USA in the 1980s and seeing his first American-style Greek salad.
I'm looking at this huge platter and I'm saying, what is going on? Because I've got, you could have anything, eggs, anchovies, stuffed vine leaves, you know, which would be a no-no in Greece. I mean, what is an egg doing in a Greek salad? It's completely off. But that's the diner version because they want to charge you an appropriate price that gives them some profit.
Another difference between a Greek salad in New York versus Athens is that instead of a liberal drizzle of virgin olive oil, as is the standard in Greece, the American version of the Greek salad started to be made with something called Greek dressing on it, which, make no mistake, despite the name, is a completely American invention. As was evident when my Greek girlfriend, Angeliki, visited the USA and saw a bottle of the stuff on the shelves.
I thought, what is this? We don't have a Greek salad dressing, it's just olive oil. And then I picked it up just out of curiosity, and the first two ingredients was water and vegetable oil. I was offended.
In Greece, even after Horiatiki is finished, Greeks will keep the plate on the table to soak up that beautiful blend of oil, veggie juices, and feta with some bread. That act even has a name, called papara. The American version of Greek dressing feels like it's striving to capture that magical concoction, but instead, at least to me, it comes across like they just dumped an American diner version of the Greek salad in a blender and turned it on high. It ain't the same. So what we've ended up with after all these years and oceans of distance between them are practically two different dishes entirely, both flying under the title of Greek salad. But as different as these two versions of the Greek salad may taste and appear, they tell a similar tale, one of globalization, of clever entrepreneurship, of a willingness, sometimes reluctantly, to adapt old tradition to meet new challenges. And as someone who eats his fair share of both versions, I'm okay with that. This isn't a death match in which I pronounce one version of the Greek salad better than the other. Both, in my opinion, are delicious in their own way. That being said, I do hope more Americans get the opportunity to experience the OG Horiadiki. But even if you don't live in one of America's major cities with an authentic Greek restaurant at hand, or have the time and money to book a flight, with just a little effort, you can still experience a proper Horiadiki at home. Because what makes the Greek Horiadiki so great is its simplicity. You don't need to be a master chef to make one. All you need is a knife and some thoughtfully purchased ingredients. Do yourself a favor and track down a solid block of authentic PDO-labeled Greek feta for your next Greek salad. Trust me, you won't regret it. That, along with some good Greek olive oil, oregano, and a few fresh vegetables, is all you need to experience the taste of Greece at home. And then, feel free to add your own little touches to make the Horiadiki your salad.
Everyone can make the best Greek salad. Just go to the market, take the products, clean them with care, cut them with care, fill them with the olive oil, fill them with whatever you want. It's your choice, your taste. This is the best Greek salad. Your choice, you know?
You need smaller pieces that are going to interact with the cheese. And then the cheese and the tomato and the cucumbers, they've got to be mixed up as well.
It's beautiful because it's simple and all of the flavors of all the ingredients, it's the way God intended. It's beautiful.
This is like the best part. And then when you're sitting on a table with Greek people and you've eaten your Greek salad, there's nothing left in the plate apart from the liquid. They're not going to give it to the waiter to take it back unless all the oil and the juice of the tomato is gone from the plate.
So the battle between solid state feta and crumble.
No crumble.
Ever.
Ever.
Thanks to Avery Thompson for bringing us today's story. If you like Proof, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you'll get new episodes as soon as they drop. And while you're there, why not leave us a rating or write us a review? It really helps other people find the show. This episode of Proof is hosted by me, Kevin Pang, and the podcast is made by the following cast of characters.
I'm Yumi Araki, the managing producer.
I'm executive producer Caitlin Kelleher.
I'm supervising producer Caroline Rickard.
I'm producer Alex Curran Cardarelli.
I'm associate producer Angelica Quintanilla.
I'm Bridget Lancaster, creator and the founding host and producer.
Audio services are provided by Ultraviolet Audio with sound design supervision by
Matt Boynton.
Scoring, mixing, and sound design by
Anya Gzeshik.
Brian Campbell of Signal Sounds composer theme music, additional music by Kyle Forster and Jordan Pearson.
Chen Margolis
is our director of post-production, and our director of production is
Diane Knox.
Fact-checking and additional research by
Sarah D. Collins.
Special thanks to Michael Gabriel, author of The History of Diners in New Jersey, for his research assistance.
Jack Bishop
is the chief creative officer, and Dan Surratt is America's Test Kitchen's CEO. Thanks to our sponsor, Plougra Premium Butter. Proof is a production of America's Test Kitchen.